This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. ورفع أبويه على العرش وخروا له سجدا وقال يا أبت هذا تأويل رؤياي من قبل قد جعلها ربي حقا وقد أحسن بي إذ أخرجني من السجن وجاء بكم من البدو من بعد أن نزغ الشيطان بيني وبين إخوتي إن ربي لطيف لما يشاء إنه هو العليم الحكيم. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى اله وصحبه اجمعين. اما بعد, once again everybody, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته. Today I try to start our contemplations on ayah number 100 of Surah Yusuf. As I mentioned before, I think this ayah deserves a couple of days of discussion that we can try to give each part at least some of its due. So I'm going to get started today and we'll see how far we get over the next week, inshallah ta'ala. You know, as we approach the end of the surah, there's almost the fight, this sense of urgency, we're near the finish line. But actually I realized after kind of looking over what's left, there's actually quite a bit of work left on the surah. And for those of you that have been regular listeners to these lectures or have heard enough of them, what I'd like you to internalize is just a couple of things. One, that it's okay to take your time with the Quran. Don't rush the Quran. And even if we take a long time studying a single ayah, that's okay. That's time well spent. And Allah says, أَفَلَا يَتَدَبَّرُونَ الْقُرْآنَ. Don't they ponder deeply into the Quran? And there's a reason for that, because there's a richness and there's a calming of the heart and the mind, and there's gifts from Allah. And the more you contemplate, the more you think about it, actually internally you start healing. So the Quran is always going to be about quality and not about quantity, right? There's no rush to learn everything there is in the Quran. Sahaba took 8 years to study Surah Al-Baqarah. And I don't, social media is about all kinds of comments, and I personally have a pretty thick skin. I don't really care about, the comments. I don't take anything personally, but I do consider them opportunities for teaching moments. Even jokingly, somebody said, there are other surahs in the Quran, like all you do is talk about Surah Yusuf. Yeah, for now, all I do is talk about Surah Yusuf. When we were discussing Surah Al-Baqarah, I think it was 2.5-3 years. Ali Imran took about 1.5 years, I think almost 2 years. So I'm completely content. I think Surah An-Nur, I studied Surah An-Nur for maybe 6-7 months before I lectured on it. And the Deeper Look series, at the very least, the fastest I've ever done is try to study a surah, like the tail end of the Quran, the Juz Amma surahs, maybe study them full time for a week and then give a comprehensive lecture on one surah. I remember those days when I used to study those surahs, and it would literally take me an entire week to study just that one short surah and then present, and sometimes more. So I take time off and just study longer times to get to, discuss, whatever surah. And I still don't think I did them justice. So the heart has to be content that we have taken a dive into an endless ocean. And we should enjoy the fact that we are getting these drops, because at the end of the day, even after a lifetime of spending, time contemplating the Quran, our entire lifetime, we're going to walk out of the Quran and we're only going to have drops on us. We're not going to have the entire ocean ever. Right. And the other, impatience that, I can have or you can have is, man, there's so many other things to talk about. Why are you talking about this? Right. And yes, there are, but why not talk about this? Is this not one of the things we should be talking about or spending time with? So, which is why I actually constantly retell myself, take your time, because this is literally it's a journey and it's a labor of love. And it should be one for all of you also. There should be, even if those of you that missed a bunch of lectures or you didn't hear, about this series until very recently and you're feeling intimidated, man, I'm so far behind. There's no race. You don't have to compete with somebody and say, hey, by the way, I finished the whole thing. Or, you don't. You could take your time with it. But you know, خير الأمور أدومها وإن قلّا, the best deeds are the ones that are consistent, even if they are little. So take your time with this stuff. And you know, really what I'm trying to leave behind, Allah decides how long life is, but what I think I can leave behind, if Allah wills, as a contribution, is something that a Muslim can at least use as a stepping stone to spend time contemplating the Quran. So I won't be the final sort of answer to what Allah has to say or final interpretation of what, you know, you should think about, but at least it's a starting point. And then from there, you can be inspired to do your own thinking, your own reading, your own questioning, your own research. Some of you might even become, you know, completely engrossed in Quranic studies. All of that can happen, inshallah ta'ala. So that's my hope. Anyway, so we are here in Ayah 100. By the way, I'm picking up my nose because it's allergy season. So bear with me, inshallah. I'll grab my napkin. So make dua, these go away. But anyway, so we are on Ayah 100 and it begins, I'll translate the part that we're going to discuss today, not the entire Ayah. وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. And he elevated both his parents onto the throne. وَخَرُّوا لَهُ سُجَّدًا. And they all fell before him in prostration. They all fell on their faces before him. وَقَالْ يَا أَبَتِي هَذَا تَأْوِيلُ رُؤْيَايَ مِنْ قَبِلْ قَدْ جَعَلَهَا رَبِّي حَقًّا. And he said, my beloved father, this is the interpretation of my vision from so long ago. Allah certainly has made it true. قَدْ جَعَلَهَا رَبِّي حَقًّا. Okay, so that's a surface translation of what we're going to be trying to discuss today. But there are two outstanding things, one not related to these ayat that Suhaib brought to my attention today, a thought that he had, and I thought it was a very beautiful thought, so I've decided to include it in the series. And that is that when we were discussing the shirt coming and the father feeling the shirt on his face, and there was a discussion about what al-bashir means, meaning when the giver of good news, when the congratulator came, you know, he put the shirt on his face. So what is the giver of good news? And one of its interpretation was that the giver of good news is not necessarily a person, it's the shirt itself. And one of the ways you can think about that is the shirt has actually already been giving good news for a while, because as the shirt gets closer, he's been getting the good news by the scent of it, right? So it's actually already been serving the role of a congratulator before it even gets there. And so it's been a bashir for him before it even got to be the final bashir on his face. Bashir meaning the giver of good news or the congratulator. The other interesting thing is bashir is an ism sifa. It's an adjective. And an adjective is used for something that continues to play a certain role. So a mubashir is someone who gives good news at a particular occasion. But a bashir is someone who continuously gives good news. And because the good vibes have been coming from the shirt for so long, it can be looked at as, because it was playing that role continuously, the word bashir is even more fitting. So it's at least one very plausible interpretation for bashir. Anyhow, coming to this ayah, there is one outstanding, or actually a connecting matter from the previous ayah. And here's the in a nutshell. When they came in, Yusuf alayhi salam pulled both of his parents into his protection. Awa ilayhi abawayhi. He pulled them both into his protection and he made them feel secure. And then he told the rest of them, you are inshallah safe. Yeah, enter Egypt safely. Udkhulu insha'allahu. Udkhulu Misra insha'allahu. Aminin. Okay. The thing that I didn't mention last time is that it's interesting that both of those actions have to do with safety. Pulling someone into your refuge is an act of safety, and telling someone you're safe, enter Egypt safely, safety is also an act of safety. But one is actually a physical gesture, is pulling them in and giving them refuge without saying a word. And the other is the words of offering safety. And so what that illustrates is he went out of his way to give safety, not just by word, but by action, by a hug, by pulling them in closer, by giving them that special treatment. That was for parents and then the rest. So it's like this takhsis. They were given this special prominence before the rest, even though the act practically, the body language of awa ilayhi abawayhi and the verbal language of udkhulu misra insha'allahu aminin is virtually the same, but one deserved more. It was more than that. So, you know, like saying to a child, for example, or saying to your parents, I love you, is one thing, but giving them a hug and saying I love you is something else, right? And it's, so there's the more special, engagement with both parents, and even though we said that it's not the biological mother, and we talked about all of that you know, background before, but he's done that and he's gone out of his way to address both of them in this way. But now let's tie it to this ayah. What he's done is made his parents feel loved and safe. Pulling someone in is an act of you care for them, you love them, and you want them to be safe. Awa ilayhi abawayhi. So there's a love and safety that's kind of been highlighted as a sentiment that he wants them to feel and that he's expressing. But now in this ayah, we go back to the parents again. وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. He elevated his parents to the throne. Obviously, to pull them towards himself literally doesn't mean he went to him, he pulled them towards himself. Which means they got up, you know, on stage. You know, if this is like a throne, so they're up higher than everybody else now, right? And now Allah repeats what he does for the parents and says he raised them to the throne. So it's as if there's an interesting redundancy, an interesting repetition. Because the fact that he pulled them in and he brought them up expresses that. Or if Allah just said he raised them to the throne, obviously that's also a place of safety and honoring and love and all of that also. So either one of them could have sufficed, but Allah mentioned both. And he didn't even use the pronoun, which is interesting to me, because when something is mentioned in Arabic, then the second time you mention it, you can refer to it as a pronoun. So you could say, وَرَفَعَهُمَا عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. And he raised both of them on the throne. And the both of them would only refer to mom and dad that were just pulled in for safety. But instead of using the pronoun, he went back to the noun, وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. Right? He pulled both of his parents onto the throne. So it's actually this divine emphasis on both parents, again, highlighting something similar yet different. So how is it different from pulling them in from safety? If you want to put emotions behind this, it's one, making them feel loved and making them feel secure. Both of them making them feel loved and secure. Like, I'll take care of you now. And the other is making them feel honored. Honoring them. And making them feel like they are not in an inferior position. Because to put them on the throne, I'll read something from Sha'rawi on the act of putting them on the throne. لِأَنَّهُ لَمْ يُحِبْ التَّمَيُّزْ عَنْهُمْ. Because he didn't want to make himself feel like he's separate or in a distinct position from them. Right? Because obviously anybody on the throne is distinct from the rest of the society. But he wants his parents to feel like this throne means nothing. You and I are not separated by this throne. The status of mind that the world acknowledges, everybody calls me Al-Aziz, everybody looks at me with disrespect, I'm a big shot now. No, not to you. You, I'm not going to distinguish myself. So I'm going to put you on the throne. رَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. So his elevation, he's making sure they understand that that doesn't mean they shouldn't treat him as anything more than just their son. And he's not expecting to be treated any more special because he's on the throne. No, you're on the throne too. So this throne now means that this is not a position of superiority for me as far as you're concerned. So it's not just a statement of honoring. It's actually setting a precedent for their relationship too. That you shouldn't have to feel intimidated that you're addressing the governor of Egypt when you talk to me about anything. You can talk to me as if I'm your son. We still have the same position. So you're not speaking to someone higher, you're speaking to someone at the same in the same place. So there's no distinction. وَهَذَا سُلُوكٌ يَدُلُّ عَلَى الْمَحَبَّةِ وَالتَّقْدِيرِ وَالْإِكْرَامِ. And Sha'rawi rahimahullah comments, and this is a kind of gesture that indicates love, and it indicates a status, giving of a status, and giving respect. So we saw first love and protection, awa ilayhi abawayhi, and now we're seeing respect, right? And a particular manifestation of respect, which is perhaps an interesting commentary in the Quran about the nature of our relationship with aging parents. Because as parents age, they start feeling insecure. You know, when as people age, they become less capable, right? They're less independent. They may not be able to do things that they used to be able to do before. They, for a long time, were the provider and the caretaker and the protector of the family. And now they're the ones in need of medical care. They're the ones in the need of, like, sometimes emotional care. They're the ones feeling lonely, or they're the ones feeling insecure. They're the ones worrying too much about something, you know. And they're the ones that are having all kinds of, you know, panicky thoughts, you know, anxieties, and they that play in their head and things like that. So the first thing is to make sure they feel secure and they physically feel your connection to them. You know, when they were little, they would go out of their way to hug you and to hold you and to pat you to sleep. And there was this physical form of affection and making you feel safe. If it was a thunder in the middle of the night, your mom or your dad came and, "I'm here, don't worry, it's okay. You're safe." And you felt as a kid that you're safe because mom's there. Or every time you felt unsafe, you ran towards them. Well, they're too old to run towards you, right? But you need to now, that role needs to be reversed, which reminds me of this beautiful ayah in Surah Al-Isra, when Allah talks about the rights of parents. I gave khutbas about it a few weeks ago. وَخْفِرْ لَهُمَا جَنَاحَ ذُلِّ مِنَ الرَّحْمَةِ In summary, Allah compares our relationship, particularly with older parents, to a bird that's protecting its nest. So, and the image is like, you know, you've got a bird, it's got a nest, the nest has eggs in it, right? Or it's got chicks in it that can't fly on their own yet. And there's a snake or some predator that's trying to eat the eggs or eat these chicks that can't protect themselves. So the bird is, even if it's no match for the snake or the predator, what it will do is it will hover its wings over the nest. So if a predator does attack, it attacks it. Or it's going to just shield it from whatever trouble's coming its way. And which is remarkable because that's an image of a parent protecting a child. But Allah used that image to say that this is what I expect you to show when you are protecting your parents. And He didn't just say, وَخْفِضْ لَهُمَا جَنَاحَكَ. He said, جَنَاحَ الذُّلْ, the wings of humility, as you are protecting them. Because you're now in the protector role, right? Now, this is different from when the parents were in a protective role, because when I'm protecting my kids, when I'm providing for my kids, when I'm securing my kids, and they disobey me, or they do something to annoy me, excuse me, that's not going to happen in my house. You better go pick up that plate. You better go clean up that room. You better finish your homework. Excuse me, who's the parent again? You can do that because you are the parent, right? You're the one protecting, and it's your house. But when the equation is flipped and they're old and now it's your house and they're the dependents, you're paying the bills and they are the beneficiaries. You're taking care of the medical expenses, they're the beneficiaries. You're the one driving them around. You're the one making sure they're okay. You're doing all that. And then they do something to annoy you. You don't get to do what they did when you were a kid. You don't get to say, excuse me, this is my house. جناح الذل, wings of humility. Wings of humility. That's the imagery in Surah Al-Isra. And here you find, you know, Yusuf alayhi salam expressing this humility to his parents in that he's elevating them to the throne. Even though he has the power to demonstrate the position he's in, he's actually not only hovering them with his wings, those wings have humility in them. So there was the hovering of the wings in awa ilayhi. And then there's the dhul, there's the, you know, janah al-dhul, the humility in rafa'a abawayhi ala al-arsh. So there's this beautiful tie-in to what's mentioned in Surah Al-Isra. It's also really interesting in a literary kind of subtlety that Surah Al-Isra, Surah number 17, is actually, the first part of it is about the Israelites. It's also called Surah Bani Israel, the Surah of the Children of Israel. Right, and this passage where the parents and humility to parents is mentioned, وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ, I believe it was Ibn Abbas radiallahu anhu, anhuma, who had the opinion that this is the equivalent of the commandments given to Moses, meaning the Israelites and the commandments they were to cherish from God, famously known as the Ten Commandments. The Quran's version of that is actually 23 to 40 in Surah number 17, from which this is a part. And why is that interesting? Because here we are talking about the original child of Israel. Israel being Yaqub. And he's his son. And he's actually literally demonstrating this. So the children of Israel know of this humility to parents by the example of their father, Israel, who was shown this kind of humility by his son, Yusuf, alayhi salam, Joseph. Right? So there's this really beautiful tie-in to that injunction in Surah Al-Isra. Anyhow, the other thing about the, you know, elevating them on the throne, that's very subtle, is that, you know, and I didn't finish that point about, you know, when parents feel like they are no longer in charge and they're no longer relevant, it is the job of the son or daughter to go out of their way to say that you still deserve the same respect and the same status as far as I'm concerned. You're on my throne. You're on my throne still. You were on my throne when I was in school. You were on my throne when you were driving. You were the king of the household. You were running things. Now you're old. Now you're not even able to take care of yourself entirely. You've lost your independence. But as far as I'm concerned, you still deserve the throne. You're still up there. And this is important because as we get older in our times and contemporary society, actually in many, many societies around the world, older parents are considered a burden, right? And they can become very difficult to deal with. And it's just a reality. Sometimes our parents are difficult to deal with. We have differences with them that are irreconcilable. And it's understandable for lots of reasons. You know, the world they grew up in is very different from the world that we grew up in. And our children are growing up in an entirely different planet. The world is changing culturally, economically, socially, psychologically so fast that it's actually literally a different universe every 20 years, every 10 to 20 years. So, you know, hard enough to relate to other human beings that are from the same time as you. It's much harder to relate to people from a previous generation or for them to relate to what's normal to you. For what makes sense to you, because their world has completely just transformed. You know, Allah created you for a different time. Allah created them for a different time. If you put somebody in a time back in the day, you know, like if you think of the story of the people of the cave, like the young people in the cave were in the cave for generations, right? So when they came out, their clothing looked ancient, right? Their currency was different. Like people could tell they don't belong in this time. Right. And that could be a few hundred years before society completely transformed. But now, if you take somebody and put them in a time capsule, not for centuries, if you bring somebody out of the 90s from a time and bring them in our time now, they would lose their mind. Like they don't belong. Like the world is completely transformed. If you took somebody, not even from a different society, if you took somebody from New York City from 1994 and then plucked them into 2020 and dropped them there, what's going on here? People have changed. Language has changed. Technology has changed. The way people communicate with each other has changed. Family has changed. Social issues have changed. What the world is talking about has changed. Donald Trump is president? They'd have a heart attack just off of that. So the point being that, you know, if the world changed so much that someone who still may relatively be in their youth, they're not an old man at that point, is seeing a completely different world. Can you imagine how far apart you are from your parents' generation as you're becoming an adult and they are of the age that, you know, the generation that they are? So relating to parents can become very difficult. What they saw as normal around them is completely out the window now. So everything is weird to them. Everything is agitating to them. Right? So there are cultural reasons, social reasons, sociological reasons, psychological reasons why there can be a lot of conflict between us and parents. But what is the ayah saying? The ayah is saying you can have those differences. But what we can draw from this is my responsibility to my parents is to still give them love and protection. And my responsibility to my parents is try to honor them so they don't feel like they're irrelevant. Like, sitting on the throne, let's talk about Yusuf alayhi salam. They're sitting on the throne, right? And let me tell you something about the throne. Al-Arsh huwa sarirul malik alladhi yuridu minhu al-hakim umur al-hukm. It is the long couch, elongated couch of the king, the comforted cushion of the king, which is meant for him to sit and deliberate his judgments on governance every day. It's basically the Oval Office, right? It's the desk from which real issues are dealt with. Or it's, if you think of it like a closer contemporary example would be, it's the Supreme Court judge's bench. Only the judge is supposed to sit there because that's his job. He's supposed to execute judgments from here. That's his job. That's his qualification. He was given this role to fulfill his responsibility. And by the way, the judge, doesn't matter how much he loves his or her parents, can't put his parents up there and say, no, you run the Supreme Court today. Their parents may not be qualified. Right, so the throne, the arsh, is actually a position of great responsibility, and it's a job. It's a high job. It's the highest job. It's an honorable job. It's your honor, but it's not just a place. It's not just a casual place. It's not like you invited your parents home or they came home for the first time, and the special sofa goes to them. It's not just a special sofa. It's the seat of power. It's the seat of where my job is. And why is that important? Because nowadays we say to our parents, "Dad, that's my job. Just kind of leave that, stay out of that, please. That's my role." Right? And even though Yusuf alayhi salam is not going to let his parents make judgments over Egypt, symbolically he's saying, my job role, as high as it is for the rest of the world, my job role is not something I will use to make you feel irrelevant. You, as far as I'm concerned, you're on my throne. So I come back to that point again. So it's nowadays we say, you know, we've got, you know, new age technology. We're running our businesses. We're providing income. We're discussing issues that our parents just fly over their head. And your dad might give you, your mom might give you business ideas that used to make sense in the 70s. And you're like, oh, why do I have to listen to this? That doesn't work like that anymore. Mom, that's not how the world works anymore. It's not like that. It's not. And you get frustrated. Oh, why do I have to have this conversation? Actually, that's the time for you to awa ilayhi abawayhi, rafa'a abawayhi al-arsh, to let your annoyance take a back seat, because you were way more annoying when you used to, you know, poop in your clothes and pee on yourself and they cleaned you up. You were way more annoying when you were screaming at the top of your lungs while your mom was trying to listen to a khutbah and everybody else was staring. And she didn't take you to a corner and beat you up. She took you to a corner and gave you a hug and cleaned you up. So let's just take a humble pill and understand, yeah, they can be difficult. Allah says, وَمَن نُعَمِّرْهُ نُنَكِّسُهُ فِي الْخَلْقِ. Surah Yasin, whoever we give old age, we start reversing them in creation, which can also mean not only do we start deteriorating and weakening their body and they become less and less capable like a child would be, like a baby would be, but also senility, like they can reason less, they can get agitated more easily, they become emotionally less capable of controlling their temper. They can have tantrums like a child has tantrums. That's just natural. Allah has made human beings like that. كَيْلَا يَعْلَمَ مِنْ بَعْدِ عِلْمٍ شَيْئًا. So even after, so that when we, you know, what Allah calls أَذَلِ الْعُمُرِ, the most weak and what's the word, powerless age, you know, where a person will, after having known so much, knows nothing. They start having short-term memory loss. They start forgetting things that they knew. They start making incoherent sentences and things like that. And this is the time where we feel like, you know, what are they contributing? They're nothing but a burden. They're just bills we have to pay. They're just conversations we have to put up with. No, rafa'a abawayhi ala al-arsh. Every ayah in this surah is a commentary on how we are to carry ourselves and understand that it could be that one of those two parents is someone that has caused Yusuf alayhi salam a lot of drama if you were to accept the Israelite account. But the Quran erases all of that because what others do should not dictate how you should carry yourself. He's starting fresh. And so wa rafa'a abawayhi ala al-arsh. It's a really powerful expression of his, you know, his honoring and his protecting of the one he loves and the one he's responsible over. And that's the last comment I'll make, that it can be extended beyond parents. Whoever we are responsible over is worthy of our love, our protection, and respect. Love, protection, and respect. Because sometimes we give one of these or two of these and not the rest. Like, I respect you a lot, but I can't protect you. Or I love you and I protect you, but I ain't giving you no respect. You know, I do enough. I pay the bills. So I get to raise my voice like this. Remember who's in charge. Like, you could do that. You could take that road. But it's kind of both that have been brought in. And it's like they're interchangeable or necessary. Lazim and Malzum, two sides of the same coin. You know, when it comes to those relationships, for those that are now in our care. Older parents are now in our care. Children, maybe, if you have younger children, they are in your care. Younger siblings might find themselves in your care. Someone you've adopted may be in your care, right? So people under your care deserve these things from you. And this is the way of this noble prophet, Yusuf alayhi salam. So now, وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. Let's go further. قَالْ هَذَا تَأْوِيلُ رُؤْيَايَا وَخَرُّ لَهُ سُجَّدًا. They fell into sajda before him. I've got a few notes on here. So they fell into sajda before him. Now this is, of course, what happened in the very beginning, right? the stars, the sun, and the moon, etc. It's a bit, heavy, this phrase. They fell into sajda before him, is how I keep translating it, in a shallow way, but it deserves a deeper look. The Imam Razi mentions seven possibilities, or seven, you can say, observations or points of view on how to understand this sajda, this prostrating, this falling on the faces before him. So I'm going to go through all of them. He prefers number one. And at the end, I'm going to mix and match these and tell you what I find the most convincing sort of cocktail of from within these opinions. But I'll go through all of them with you briefly. I'll start with number two, not number one. I want to mention number one last. Number two, that they prostrated in his direction, but prostrated to Allah out of gratitude. So towards him, but actually to Allah. Now let me explain what that means. The Kaaba is we don't pray, we don't do sajda to the Kaaba. We do sajda towards the Kaaba, but we're actually doing sajda to Allah, right? But technically what it looks like is we're prostrating to a stone, a creation of Allah. The Kaaba is a creation of Allah. It's simply a direction, but not the object of our worship. The object of our worship, the purpose of our sajda is always Allah, regardless of the direction. You understand? So in ancient times, sajda is done for two scenarios. I mean, this is my addition to this extrapolation. Okay, there are two scenarios I can pull out from the study of Quran that sajda is called for. Sajda is done as an act of worship. And as an act of worship, it is done towards the house of Allah, and especially in the family of Ibrahim alayhi salam, right? Because this is the family of Ibrahim alayhi salam. So let's add that to the equation. Ibrahim alayhi salam was responsible for building the Kaaba. And because he built the Kaaba, and Allah, as he was raising the foundations of the Kaaba with his son Ismail, Allah told him that this house is being built for those who will come and go around it, al-ta'ifin, those who will spend time here and worship, separating themselves from worldly issues. Al-Aqifin, like i'tikaf, what we call i'tikaf. Wal-ruk'i sujood, and people that are going to do ruku', bowing, you know, while standing, and sujood, falling on their faces. In other words, the Kaaba is being built, and one of its fundamental purposes is, this is for those who want to do sajda to me. This is why it's being built. This was given to Ibrahim alayhi salam as his final award. Like after all of his trials, you get the honor of building what? The Kaaba, which is going to be the direction of sajda, for anyone who wants to actually make sajda to Allah, yes? Now, Ibrahim clearly taught that to Ismail, and clearly also taught that to Ishaq, his other son. It's not like he'll teach him a different religion, right? And Ishaq is even younger, which means not earlier, but later on. The Kaaba is already built. That's already done, you know? And so he's going to teach his son Ishaq the same thing. And in Surah Al-Baqarah, Allah bunches Ismail and Ishaq together. So earlier on, the Kaaba is being built. Later on, the children of, the child of Ibrahim is Ishaq. Ishaq has Yaqub. Yaqub is asking his kids, what will you worship? And they say, the God of your fathers, Ibrahim and Ishaq. In other words, the idea that sajda is going to be done to Allah alone and will be done towards the Kaaba is established. This family knows that sajda is done towards the Kaaba, right? But which sajda? The sajda of worship is done towards the Kaaba. But the Quran also talks about sajda in a different situation. It's kind of worship, but it's something a little more or a little different. And that is when something overwhelming or miraculous happens in somebody's life, where Allah has intervened and has brought them in awe of what He's done. Like when a creation of Allah is overwhelmed by the power of God manifest in a miracle, then they can't even help themselves. They fall on their faces. They fall on their faces in sajda. Now, I'll describe this to you. In Surah Al-Isra, and this Surah Al-Isra is Makkah. So in Makkah, the idea that the sajda is only done towards the Kaaba hasn't even been established yet. Okay? That's not even given yet. And Allah describes people who hear the Quran for the first time. People of the book that hear the Quran, sincere people of the book, that hear the Quran for the first time. And He says that when they hear the word of Allah, يَخِرُّونَ لِلْأَذْقَانِ سُجَّدًا, they fall on their faces in sajda. And you don't necessarily imagine that they say, which way is the Kaaba again? And I'll fall in sajda. The images, they just collapse before God. They put their head on the ground. The direction becomes irrelevant now. They are, the way you can describe that, that is, they put their head on the ground in face of, in, you know, when they come into contact with God's miracle, right? The silly example I'd like to give you that's contemporary is when Pakistan cricket team wins a match, like the half the team just falls into sajda. I don't have to check sajda, qibla direction first, but they just fall on their faces, you know, because they're like, oh, this must be a divine intervention that we won this match. So, but the idea being, okay, out of gratitude. So the opinion here is actually, it was towards Yusuf, because Yusuf and the fact that he survived and the fact that the family is united in this way and the fact that the parents have been honored in this way, there's so much to be grateful for in a time of uncertainty and famine and danger that the entire family is now safe. Like there's an overwhelming feeling of gratitude, and all of it, Allah made it happen because of this miraculous, you know, intervention in the life of Yusuf alayhi salam. So they fall in sajda before what they see as a miracle. So it's in his direction, but not toward, not to him, just towards him. It's still for Allah. And that might be a way of looking even at the sajda that was done by the angels before Adam. Adam is a miracle, is a miracle creation of Allah. And Allah says, are you not? So they're not doing sajda to Adam. This is different from saying they did sajda to Yusuf alayhi salam out of honoring him. That's not the view here. The view is they're seeing that as a, what's happened with Yusuf as a miracle. And that's humbled them and made them fall on the sajda, and the direction becomes irrelevant. So it's not to him because he's the miraculous, he's the recipient of the miracle. You understand? And then, but it's still done to Allah. Now, others have translated the third attempt to interpret this. Again, I skipped number one on purpose. The third attempt to interpret this is that kharru has been translated as marru, or interpreted figuratively, to suggest that they simply humbled themselves. So the phrase sujjadan is used as an act of humility. The first objection to that is, well, it doesn't just say sajadu, they fell into prostration, because poetry uses mountains doing sajda to the horses that trample over them. Like the horses were not, you know, done in by the elevation of the mountains, and the poet will describe in ancient Arabia that the mountains are doing sajda to these horses. Right? What does that mean? That the mountains have been humbled by the horse, right? So they say, well, as a figurative poetic expression, it might mean that the family was humbled before Yusuf, right? The problem with that is the verbiage in the Quran is not they did sajda, it says they fell in sajda. خَرُّ لَهُ سُجَّدًا. So the falling makes it very literal. And then the objection to the response to that objection that Razi quotes is, well, perhaps you can look at kharru as marru. And he cites some example in the Quran elsewhere where you might look at it that way. Not a very strong argument as far as I'm concerned, but okay, we'll at least accept that possibility as one mentioned, recorded in scholarly tradition, and that is that they became humbled before him. So it's not saying it literally, they were humbled before him. Now, the fourth one, this things get really interesting, doesn't necessarily include the parents. He raised them on the throne. The language is, he raised both his parents on the throne and they fell into sajda. So if they're raised on the throne, there's not much room to do sajda up there. But you can imagine in a king's court when, you know, in ancient times, oh, great king, and, you know, somebody bows in front of the king, they're not up on the throne, they're at the bottom. And the king or the high noble is up there. That's not the place to do sajda. That down there is the place to do sajda. So some have actually postulated that when it says they bowed down, again, the reason can still be because of Allah, but they bowed down in humility or they bowed down in awe of Allah's miracle. But it was the children, his brothers, and maybe even their families that fell into sajda. But the parents were already elevated before that could happen. So they were elevated. But then the question becomes, well, how does that become an interpretation of the dream? Because the dream was 11 stars, the sun, and the moon, right? So they should all be doing sajda. And the objection there are answers to that. One being that Fakhruddin Razi says that sometimes a dream doesn't have to be interpreted entirely literally. like the idea overall has been established. So he says you don't have to be so literal about the dream. That's his way of looking at it. Interestingly, though, the language kind of did make it difficult, because them being raised first and then everybody else falling on the sajda is kind of a separation between the parents and the children, right? And scholars also had this interesting objection, because here you have him protecting his parents. Here you have him honoring his parents. So he would have a hard time accepting his parents doing sajda. Right? Because that's the opposite, right? They're humbling themselves before him. But everything that's been said so far is he's humbling himself before them. He's not humbling himself before his brothers, but he certainly is humbling himself before the parents. Now, I suggested this to as we were discussing this with Suhaib, the thought came to me to go back to the ayah of the dream, right? Where this all started. It's interesting that in the ayah, here's the language, إِنِّي رَأَيْتُ أَحَدَ عَشَرَ كَوْكَبًا, I saw 11 stars, وَالشَّمْسَ, along with, you could translate this, 11 stars, along with the sun and the moon. Okay, I mean, I used along with, like, وَاوَ الْمَعِيَّ, okay? I saw 11 stars, not only 11 stars, I also saw the sun and the moon. But then he stops. And he says, رَأَيْتُهُمْ لِي سَاجِدِينَ, I saw them doing sajda towards me. Okay, that's the verbiage. Now, you see, I translated I saw them. Now think of it in English. I saw 11 stars. Here's what is not said. Let me qualify. Here's what is not said. I saw 11 stars, the sun and the moon prostrating before me. That is what is not said. Here's what is said. I saw 11 stars. And along with the 11 stars, the sun and the moon too. I saw them doing sajda to me. I saw them doing sajda to me. So the word them has been repeated. This time the word them represents something that has been mentioned before. But it can't. The word them creates a grammatical ambiguity. You can look at it as all of them did sajda to me. You can also look at it as I saw 11 stars. And by the way, the 11 stars, what I could also see was the sun and the moon. Not only the 11 stars, but coming back to the 11 stars, I saw them doing sajda to me. So the them could actually just pick on the 11 stars and skip the parents in potentially in the language of the ayah originally. It can be looked at that way. There's a possibility. And I actually personally like that possibility, because it solves the problem of Yusuf alayhi salam not accepting. Why, you know, put yourself in that position. How would you accept your father or mother or someone in the mother's position to be humbled before you when you're going out of your way to what? Honor them. And even if they were trying to do that, no, not you, dad, not you. That's natural, right? That's what you would expect to have happen. Not like he's humbled before and he says, dad, this is what it meant. Like, that doesn't seem to add up very well, right? But others have tried to stick to, even the parents fell into sajda, which is a plausible yet possible explanation. These are both very possible is what I'm saying. And if you stick with that explanation, they have to explain how could he accept, you know, we in our religion understand children showing humility to parents. How is this scenario okay where the parents are showing humility to the child? Well, that's because then they compare this to the example of Ibrahim alayhi salam. When Ibrahim alayhi salam was told to slaughter his son, you just do what you're told. It doesn't matter who's in what position. The child has a right to be protected. The child has a right to be kept safe. The child has a right to, the last place they should be hurt by from is the parent. But the command is to slaughter your child, right? But when Allah commands something, you do as you're told. And your feelings and other things that were normal outside of that are out the window because Allah commanded it. So because Yaqub knew that this is a dream from Allah, from before, because as soon as Yusuf said the dream to him in the beginning of the story, Yaqub knew this is revelation, which is why he said Allah will complete his favor on you, right? So he knows this is revelation. And revelation of a prophet is a command. A dream of a prophet, rather, is a command. It's revelation. And Yaqub now knows from revelation, this is the time. This is the moment. So he's actually not humbling himself in awe of what's happened with Yusuf. The interpretation is he's obeying Allah's command to fall in sajda, which he knew about from the dream. And so therefore, Yusuf is not having a problem stopping him, because Yusuf also understands that this is him obeying Allah's command. And so that's the reconciliation. If you say the parents did do sajda, in fact, that would be the reconciliation. So those are both views that I've kind of put before you. Okay. So now, the fifth view is that sajda was done. It was normal back in the day for honoring somebody. And this is understandable in the time of kings. Even in the Bible, you have people that are humbled before somebody or honoring somebody. They fall in prostration. So they say that this was just a thing that was done and it had nothing to do with worship. And that's an opinion. And but the rejection of that is, if that was the case, then Yusuf should be doing sajda to his father before he could do sajda to him. Because if it's the idea of honoring someone, then the child should honor the parent before the parent even honors the child, right? So the fact that we don't see Yusuf do that is also kind of indication that that may not be the rationale behind that sajda. So even Razi kind of mentions that objection to that view to begin with. He prostrated. Now, this is an interesting add-on. The idea that the sajda should be done. Let's go with the idea that it was revealed that the sajda should be done, right? If you go with that idea, the brothers don't know about the dream still. Because remember in the beginning, the father said, don't tell your sons, don't tell your brothers the dream. So the only one who knows that sajda should be happening is the father. And it's not like the brothers are so spiritually inclined that they are immediately going to fall into sajda. If that was, in my opinion, the time to fall into sajda and humility was the first time when he said, I am your brother, right? I am Yusuf and this is my brother. No harm shall fall on you today. That was the ultimate humility for them. And that's the time they should have fallen into sajda actually, because that's when it really dawned on them, right? It's not like it's dawned on them now. It dawned on them back then. So then what is this? How did this work? How did this actually play out? Well, the way it played out, perhaps, is that Yaqub alayhi salam recognizes that Allah has alleviated all of his grief and all of his pain. And he has made Shaitan's plot to destroy this family fail. And in recognition of Allah's favor on him, he is not only obeying Allah's command, he's falling into sajda out of gratitude. He's falling into sajda out of gratitude to Allah. And the gratitude to Allah towards the blessing being Yusuf, right? And in doing so, he's actually setting an example for his sons to do the same. Like he's leading by example by doing that. So he falls into sajda, and the sons realize that they should fall into sajda also. But the rationale, in number six, Razi mentions an interesting thing. He says that the father may have recognized that even though socially, in the worldly sense, the brothers have been humbled, they may still have agitation and pride within them that, man, we have to humble ourselves before him. And he wants to kill any element of pride or agony inside of them that they are now subdued by the brother that they tried to get rid of by first humbling himself in gratitude to Allah and letting that pride be killed and let them fall in line, like leading them by example. So that's the kind of the scenario being he went first, also because he was the only one who knew that sajda should be done. And then the rest of them followed into sajda. Okay, so seven was actually something I already illustrated, that Allah instructed him and Yaqub alayhi salam went along. Now I'm going to read the one that I like the most. And I'll combine from everything I told you guys, okay? Al-wajh al-awwal, the first interpretation. The first possibility. وَهُوَ قَوْلُ إِبْنِ عَبَّاسٍ And it's the statement of Ibn Abbas فِي رِوَايَةِ عَطَى In the narration transmitted by عَطَى أَنَّ الْمُرَادِ بِهَذِهِ الْآيَةِ أَنَّهُمْ خَرُّوا لَهُ أَيْ لِأَجْلِ وَجْدَانِهِ سَجَدَ لِلَّهِ تَعَالَى That they fell to him is actually fell because of him, because of having found him, and they bowed down to Allah. وَحَاصِلُ الْكَلَامِ And what you get from that interpretation, أَنَّ ذَلِكَ السُّجُودِ كَانَ سُجُودًا لِلشُّكْرِ That this sajda was simply, this prostration was simply a prostration of gratitude. فَالْمَسْجُودُ لَهُ هُوَ اللَّهِ And the one being prostrated to actually is Allah. إِلَّا أَنَّ ذَلِكَ السُّجُودِ إِنَّمَا كَانَ لِأَجْلِهِ Because that sajda was, and it was only being done because of what Allah did with Yusuf. وَالدَّلِيلُ عَلَى صِحَّةِ هَذَا التَّأْوِيلِ And the evidence that makes this a more substantiated interpretation is أَنَّ قَوْلَهُ in that he said, وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ وَخَرُّوا لَهُ سُجَّدًا That he raised his parents on the throne
and they fell because of him in prostration, mush'irun, making one feel, بِأَنَّهُمْ سَعِدُوا ذَلِكَ السَّرِيرِ, that they had already raised up, climbed up on the throne. The parents had already climbed up on the throne. ثُمَّ سَجَدُوا لَهُ, then they prostrated because of him. وَلَوْ أَنَّهُمْ سَجَدُوا لِيُوسُفِ لَسَجَدُوا لَهُ قَبْلَ السُّعُودِ عَلَى السَّرِيرِ, and had they prostrated to Yusuf, they would have done so before getting up on the throne. Because the direction towards Yusuf would be off the throne, not on the throne. لِأَنَّ ذَلِكَ أَدْخَلُ فِي التَّوَاضُعِ, because that would be more appropriate in demonstrating humility. فَإِنْ قَالُوا فَهَذَا التَّأْوِيلُ لَا يُطَابِقُ قَوْلَهُ وَقَالَ يَا أَبَتِي هَذَا تَأْوِيلُ رُؤْيَايَ مِنْ قَبْلِ, and if people contend with this interpretation, saying this doesn't go along with what was said after that, my father, this is the interpretation of my vision from so long ago. وَالْمُرَادُ مِنْهُ إِنِّي رَأَيْتُ أَحَدَ عَشَرَ كَوْكَبًا وَالشَّمْسَ وَالْقَمَرَ رَأَيْتُهُمْ لِسَاجِدِينَ, and the meaning of that being that I saw 11 stars, the sun and the moon prostrating. قُلْنَا بَلْ هَذَا مُطَابِقُ, no, it does go along with that original dream. وَيَكُونُ الْمُرَادُ مِنْهُ, and the interpretation of or the meaning of that dream would be مِنْ قَوْلِهِ وَالشَّمْسَ وَالْقَمَرَ رَأَيْتُهُمْ لِسَاجِدِينَ, that the sun and the moon, I saw all of them doing sajda because of me, not to me. So the original meaning would have been because of me to begin with, which means this interpretation would go along with it. سَجَدَتْ لِلَّهِ لِطَلَبِ مَصْلَحَتِي وَالسَّعِي فِي إِعْلَاءِ مَنْصَبِي, they prostrated to Allah because of, you know, to seek, you know, maslahati walissa'i fi i'la'i mansabi, and you know, in order to understand the effort that was put in, you know, and the works that were put in to raise me to my status. Wa idha kana hadha muhtamalan saqata as-su'alu 'indi anna hadha ta'wil muta'ayyad, and if that is the possibility, then the idea that this interpretation, this can really be the only right interpretation. The annahu yab'udu min aqli Yusuf, because it, as far as Razi sees it, because it seems impossible for me from the mind of Yusuf, wa dinihi, from his thought process and his religion, an yarda bi an yasjuda lahu abuhu ma'a sabiqatihi fi huquq al-wilada wa shaykhukha wal-ilm wad-din wa kamal an-nubuwa, that he would be content with his father bowing down before him in sajda, knowing that he takes precedence over him in the right of parenthood, in old age, in knowledge, in religion, and in the completion of prophecy, meaning he's a prophet senior to him. So because of all of those reasons, I don't see that the mind of Yusuf would accept sajda, even out of that interpretation. Like, he understands this interpretation to mean that the father didn't actually bow down, that they did, and they did so also because of Yusuf, not to Yusuf. So that's a really beautiful add-on to, and that's number one in Razi's opinion, that's the one he finds most convincing. And that's what's happened here. They have now fallen in awe before Yusuf alayhi salam. Parents are up on the throne, both of them, right? And what does he do? That's what I'm going to end with. I was going to talk to you about part of this ayah, and even part of this ayah took a long time, but I do want to cover this part because this shouldn't take long. وَقَالَ, and he said, يَا أَبَتِي, my beloved father. It's so cool because the last time we heard يَا أَبَتِي was يَا أَبَتِي إِنِّي رَأَيْتُ أَحَدَ عَشَرَ كَوْكَبًا, my beloved father, I saw 11 stars, the sun and the moon. Now he says, my beloved father, I see 11 stars, the sun and the moon. Right? So it was years ago, it was I saw, and it was with fear, anxiety. I'm not sure what this means. And now so many years later, when he says Ya Abati, it echoes that Ya Abati from so many years ago. It's as if in his mind, even though he's a grown adult running a country, he's back to being that child again. And he's in the company of his beloved father again. And it's all about that dream all over again. That conversation is now echoed again. And he says, هَذَا تَأْوِيلُ رُؤْيَايَ مِنْ قَبْلِ, this was behind, this is the interpretation behind my vision from so long ago. Dad, this is what it meant. Oh my God, Dad, this is what it meant. I came to you with a question about what it meant. Remember? And you said, Allah will complete his favor on you. Now listen to, not just the dream. Listen to what Yaqub saw was behind the dream. Let me pull it open. You need to just connect these dots. It's so powerful. When he said this to his father, he said, وَكَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ. Listen to these words again now. That is how Allah has selected you for a special task. Do you see Yusuf being selected for special tasks all along? وَيُعَلِّمُكَ مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْحَدِيثِ. And this is how he's going to be teaching you the interpretation of all kinds of speech. Do we see that all along? وَيُتِمُّ نِعْمَتَهُ عَلَيْكَ. And he will make sure the favor on you has been completed. He will complete his favor on you. Did he keep on completing his favor? Piece by piece by piece, every Lego piece, every puzzle piece kept coming closer and closer to completion. وَعَلَىٰ آلِ يَعْقُوبَ. Listen to this. He will complete his favor on you and on the family of Yaqub. Now, on the family of Yaqub, you could say, is who? The family of Yaqub is his other kids. It's his wife. It's their kids in the future. And it's not, the family of Yaqub is not the fathers of Yaqub. How do we know that? كَمَا أَتَمَّهَا عَلَىٰ أَبَوَيْكَ مِنْ قَبْلِ. Like he completed it on your father, you're both your fathers from so long ago, Ibrahim and Ishaq. Wait, that means the family of Yaqub is something else, and the fathers of Yaqub in the phrase are something else. The family of Yaqub is, Allah is going to do you a huge favor, and who else? All of them a huge favor. That's what Yaqub said so long ago. Yaqub alayhi salam's words fit like a glove to what's happening right now. And now he, because that's what Yaqub said, generally speaking, in abstract terms, in Allah's grand plan terms, not the specifics, because Yaqub can't know the specifics. But what Allah has revealed to him is, he's going to complete his favor. You're going to learn interpretation of all kinds of speech. He's going to complete his favor, not just on you, on the entire family of Jacob. The entire family of Jacob is blessed. Then you find, later on, Yaqub saying, Asallahu an ya'tiyani bihim jami'a. Maybe Allah will bring all of them to me. Hopefully Allah will bring all of them to me. And they called him crazy. But he knew from the beginning, this favor is for the entire family. It's all going to work out in the end. And now he turns to dad. He remembers what dad said so long ago. Not only a favor on me, but a favor on everyone. And so he turns to dad and he says, when he says to him, هَذَا تَأْوِيلُ رُؤْيَا مِنْ قَبْلِ. This is the interpretation of my dream from so long ago, my vision from so long ago. قَدْ جَعَلَهَا رَبِّي حَقَّ. My master has made it all real. Can also mean made it all true, made it all materialized. Now, what has Allah made true? The dream, right? But look at it in a deeper way. Allah has taken something that was seen in a dream and turned it into reality over the last couple of decades, or 30 years, or 40, however long it was. Let's not even go into how many years, who cares? That's not the issue. The issue is a lifetime of struggle. He looks back at that lifetime of struggle, and now the way he looks at all of that tragedy is inside this one phrase, that was Allah making it real. It's not just right now they're doing sajda, therefore that dream has become real. That's become a reality, it's been proven true. But he's actually even commenting, Allah was making it true all along. It's as if you see the final building, and now you look back at the struggle of the construction. And while the construction's happening, you don't know what the final product's going to look like. The architect knows. You don't know. He just tells you, put the brick here, put the brick here. I wonder how this is going to work. You don't see the final product. He does. And now he says, it is the final product, exactly what you said so many years ago. Not only what I saw, what you thought it meant has been made real, has been brought into reality. قَدْ جَعَلَهَا رَبِّي حَقَّ. And haqq also actually means purpose. In Arabic, so cool. Oh, he could have said, وَجَعَلَ رَبِّي صِدْقًا. وَجَعَلَهَا رَبِّي صِدْقًا. Truth. Allah made it true. My dream came true. And this is the word that's used for Rasulullah ﷺ when he saw the dream. لَقَدْ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ رَسُولَهُ الرُّؤْيَا. Right? Allah was made the dream of the Prophet ﷺ true. But here, instead of صِدْق, which is the word for truth, haqq is used, which is the word for truth. And haqq is a little bit different from sidq for a few reasons, but one of them that I want to highlight to you right now is that it actually means purpose. Allah made this dream come true. He made it into something purposeful. Every event happened for a purpose, and the final purpose actually was that good would come to this entire family, and they would be humbled before Allah. They would recognize Allah. They would remove shaitan from their hearts. And so Allah made that a purpose for all of them too. It wasn't just purposeful for me. It wasn't just purposeful for you. It was purposeful for the entire family. And along with that, there was a massive purpose served for the people of Egypt. There was a massive purpose served for future generations to come. You know, and it's interesting that this is the dream, and this is the reason for which the entire legacy of the Israelites and of prophecy continues. Because their entire saga happens because these brothers were united. That's why they became the 12 tribes of Israel, right? And from now on, despite the infighting that will happen later on, the 12 tribes remain 12 tribes. 12 brothers remain 12 brothers, 12 families that stick together. And throughout all of their tribes, the trials, they remain 12 tribes. And the prophets that come speak to all 12 tribes, regardless of which tribe they come from, which one of the 12 tribes they come from. So Ali Yaqub, the future lineages of Yaqub, all of that favor started with this dream. The legacy of the Israelites has been initiated, of Allah continuing the chain of prophets, prophecy from within their, you know, their generations. قَدْ جَعَلَهَا رَبِّي حَقَّ. Allah has made it come true. And this is actually, you know, the most natural reading of it is the excitement of someone who's reminiscing the moment of their childhood. And yeah, it's not a statement of fact. It's not kalam khabari, like, by the way, dad, this is what it meant. You see, now Allah made it true. No. This, dad, this is what it meant. Allah made it all real. Look at how Allah made it all real. It's a statement of excitement, of love. When something like that happens, it could be as if it's a statement of fact. Yes, I know, son, obviously. He's not informing his dad. He's expressing his excitement, his humility, his awe of Allah, putting everything, all the pieces together in this remarkable way. And so he has this moment with his father. So it's remarkable as things are tying together. You've got the story started with a moment with the father, and it's culminating with a moment with the father. And it opened up with Ya Abati, my beloved father, and it's about to close with Ya Abati. And it's also interesting that the reverse has happened. There he saw 11 stars, then the sun, then the moon. Here he takes the sun and the moon and addresses them first, and then the 11 stars. So it's like the mirror image of what started in the beginning. And I haven't even talked to you about the structure and the coherence of the surah. That's a later project, inshallah. We'll do that as part of this series. But some things just stick out so glaringly, you just have to mention them. So قَدْ جَعْلَهَا رَبِّي حَقَّ. And from here we get some just incredible speech from Yusuf alayhi salam, and he's going to be talking to his father, which is even more incredible. He's not talking to everybody. He's talking to his dad in what he's about to say. So this is a personal conversation between two victims. Look at it that way. Two victims are going to talk to each other. And that's what we're going to talk about, inshallah ta'ala, in our next session. How are they going to talk about what happened with them? When two victims talk to each other, typically, how do they talk? And then we think, look at these two victims and see how they spoke. We're going to compare and contrast what typically happens and what happens with these two. Barakallahu li wa lakum fil Qur'an al-Hakim wa nafa'ani wa iyyakum bil ayati wa dhikri al-Hakim. Okay, hold on. This will be vertical. Let's see how far I can go vertically.
That good? Okay.
No, it's done! Ended already? Oh my God.